Okay, so the reading is Isaiah 41, starting at verse 11 through to verse 20. Behold, all who are incensed against you shall be put to shame and confounded. Those who strive against you shall be as nothing and shall perish. You shall seek those who contend with you, but you shall not find them. Those who war against you shall be as nothing at all. For I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. It is I who say to you, fear not, I am the one who helps you. Fear not, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel. I am the one who helps you, declares the Lord. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I make of you a threshing sledge, new, sharp, and having teeth. You shall thresh the mountains and crush them, and you shall make the hills like chaff. You shall winnow them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the tempest shall scatter them. And you shall rejoice in the Lord, in the Holy One of Israel, you shall glory. When the poor and needy seek water and there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will put in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, and the olive. I will set in the desert the cypress, the plane, and the pine together, that they may see and know, may consider and understand together, that the hand of the Lord has done this, the Holy One of Israel has created it.
Great, thanks, Carrie. Thanks everyone for coming tonight, it's great. So I was going to ask for feedback first, from the question you had around tables. What does it feel like to be on God's side? What did people come up with? Any volunteers?
It's awful, sometimes you have a sense of community, but other times we can feel quite isolated.
Okay, so sense of community, but isolated for people on the line. Great, yeah, agree. What else?
So sometimes it can feel quite costly or quite a burden, but then on the flip side, a real privilege to be in a relationship with God and be able to pray to Him.
Mm. So costly and a burden, but also sometimes a privilege. Yeah, it's great. Anything from this table? So you didn't have very long. That's...
You said it can become very transactional. You do this, you get this.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, Christian life can feel transactional. I totally agree. Mm. Yeah, yeah. So encouraging, but sometimes things go a bit, go a bit awry. No, totally agree. Yeah, there's lots of feelings. It's basically the whole of life, isn't it? But yeah. So now we're going to think a little bit about how an Israelite might have answered that very same question back in Isaiah's day, because I think that'll be relevant to our passage. So let's imagine an Israelite. So Steve is an Israelite living 700 BC. Steve's a potter by trade, although he doesn't have much money. His favourite pastime is retail therapy. I imagine it was somewhat popular in those days. It must have been. Maybe he likes browsing the market stalls and gawping at Mr. Musk's selection of zero-emission donkeys. He'll never be rich enough to afford them, but it's fun to look anyway. But anyway, he's also a keen Jew, and he holds on to God's promises, and he listens diligently to the law. So he's a good person to ask. So we ask Steve, what's it feel like to be on God's side? And from this point in Isaiah, we would think he might answer this. He would answer, on God's side? What do you mean? We're not on God's side anymore. And he's certainly not on ours. Didn't you know we've rejected him for centuries? And now what Isaiah says is a terrible punishment coming to us. We're going into exile. We're losing the land he promised. We'll hardly be a people at all. And it just doesn't get much worse than this. And so Steve might wonder if God has any patience left for Israel. But last week, we saw that wonderfully he does. If we look down at verse 8, so chapter 41, verse 8. You, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend. And those aren't the words of someone who's given up on Israel, are they? Despite Israel's rejection, God calls them servant, chosen, children of my friend. And these warm relational words would tell Steve, tell Israel, that God hasn't forgotten them. He won't abandon them, and his promises stand. So just imagine hearing those words as an Israelite, knowing how terribly you've treated God and the fact that you're waiting for this exile. God hasn't abandoned you. You're his servant, chosen people, the children of my friend. And we can rest on the same sort of promise today. If we trust on Jesus, we are God's chosen people. And we can know that he's on our side. He's forgiven us. He'll sustain us and rescue us. And actually, like Israel, he'll do it not because we've been doing all the right things, but simply because he has promised it. So if we're his, God will forever call us servant, chosen, children of my friend. Now, we could spend longer on this, but we covered a lot of that last week. And our passage today takes this a step further. So Isaiah wants Steve to be able to answer that question we saw. What's it feel like to be on God's side? With the word, fearless. Now, Steve isn't quite ready to say that yet. So today's passage will get him and hopefully get us all the way there to fearless. Quite a big challenge, isn't it? I don't know when, if ever, I'd describe my worldview as actually fearless. It's usually a bit crowded with fear, to be honest. Fear of people, fear of the future, uncertainty. And so honestly, it'll take some pretty big worldview-shifting teaching to change my mind. But fortunately, that's what we get in this passage. So I think it's very exciting. Let's crack on with it. So if we're facing hard times and fear sets in, what might we expect to hear? Well, our friends might say something like, don't worry, it'll be all right. Which is a nice thing to hear. In Isaiah, God says something a bit like this, but just a few thousand times better. Oops, I can't turn my pages quickly off. So read with me from verse 13. So our key verse. So if, yeah, this is really it, this verse. Verse 13. For I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. It is I who say to you, fear not, I am the one who helps you. See, Isaiah replaces this, don't worry, it'll be all right, with fear not, I am the one who helps you. We see God's plan to make Israel fearless by giving them promises of help from God. And so this is how we're going to spend the rest of our time together. We're going to look at two big reasons to be fearless in our walk through life. First reason, it's God who helps us. Second reason, how God has promised to help us. And if we really get this, we'll be able to answer that question. What's it feel like to be on God's side? Fearless. So, first reason to be fearless, it's God who helps us. Look down with me again at verse 13. Sorry, I know we just looked at it, but it's a good verse. For I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. It is I who say to you, fear not, I am the one who helps you. Fear not, you worm, Jacob, you men of Israel. I am the one who helps you, declares the Lord. See the repetition there? I hold your right hand. I who say, fear not, I am the one who helps you. See how God roots all those promises in himself. He really wants Israel to think about who the promises come from. Not just rush onto the contents of the promises, but he wants them to know that the promises, they're guaranteed by God himself. And as we think about this, we should remember that just as Israel represented God's people, God's chosen people then, those who trust in Jesus as Savior are God's chosen people now. As New Testament believers, we have a similar relationship. We've got more clarity on what the promises actually are, and more detail on how God's plan comes together. But the statement, I am the one who helps you, could equally be written to New Testament believers. So that's good, we can follow the same implications. Back to it then, God roots those promises in himself. To understand this properly, we're going to have to draw our minds back and draw on everything we've seen about God so far in Isaiah. It's quite a lot, really. So very briefly, in chapter 40, we saw that his is a global glory. He and his words are eternal. He is mighty. The oceans are like a little drop of water in his hand. He had original knowledge. He is incomparable. He dictates the lives of princes. He knows and directs the stars. He created everything. We saw that we just can't ever have a big enough view of God. He is mighty and sovereign beyond our imagination. And so here when he says, I am the one who helps you, he invokes all of that. Just think, God, who created the stars and rules history, chose to make promises to a small group of seemingly insignificant people. Well, maybe for anything like me, numbers might help put it into context. So I think numbers always help. Apparently, over your life, you might consume 1 million kilowatt hours of energy. I'm really not sure if this will land, but anyway, 1 million kilowatt hours of energy per person. Sounds like a lot, doesn't it? Now, God flung the sun into space quite a while back now, but each second, I gather from Google, it puts out 10 to the power 20 kilowatt hours. So, you know, my maths might be wrong, but it looks like it exceeds the lifetime energy consumption at today's rates, which is not you know, it's pessimistic, of everyone who's ever lived every second. Every second. So, but the point being that God sprinkled stars like our sun, quite a few more, out into space, and they're just small to him. But amazingly, God, that God, still thinks it's important to reassure a tiny group of people on a tiny planet about what he will do for us. God is mighty beyond our comprehension, and it's he who makes these promises. So I think that's one practical outbox from these verses. Whenever we're reminded of one of these big truths about God, we can safely add, and he is the one who helps me. So maybe another example, maybe we spend some time thinking about God's eternal nature. He's uncreated, unwearying, constant through eternity. Then after thinking about that for a bit, we can add, and he is the one who helps me. I mean, why should we be concerned about any external pressure or enemy with God on our side? And could it ever be reasonable to doubt if God will do as he says? Well, no, nothing at all could ever take these promises away. They're from God. They're more reliable than gravity. God, the eternal creator, has given his people these guarantees. I am the one who helps you. Well, as we look at the rest of verses 11 to 13, we see also a contrast between God, the one who helps us, and the enemies who oppose God and his people. So let's listen to the promises from verse 11 now. So down at verse 11. Behold, all who are incensed against you shall be put to shame and confounded. Those who strive against you shall be as nothing and shall perish. You shall seek those who contend with you, but you shall not find them. Those who war against you shall be as nothing at all. Well, all these verses, they actually repeat a similar idea. Israel's enemies will one day come to nothing. Just think of how an Israelite might feel looking out at those mighty conquerors, Babylon, who are coming to take their land. Or for a recent analog, imagine how a Ukrainian might feel having to watch hopelessly as the amassed might of the Russian army just pushes into their country. Those enemies that strive against God's people, they're scary. They're real and scary. They seem to be unassailable. But from these verses, we know we can look forward to the eventual outcome. And it won't matter if those enemies they're a powerful king or a nation or just another anybody. Whoever they are, they'll be as nothing and shall perish. Because compared to God, we just saw, they're already nothing. Their power is limited in time and space. And more importantly, it's limited to exactly what God permits them to do. Remember chapter 41, verse 2, the question, who stirred up one from the east? Well, the actual question was there, who kicks this powerful conquering army into action? The answer, God. And this tells us that God is in control even today. And that's true today, but the promise of verses 11 to 13 tell us that one day it will be abundantly obvious. You shall seek those who contend with you, but you shall not find them. And as I studied this bit, I was struck by the fact that it doesn't sound like a final battle, does it? It's not a final epic showdown of good versus evil. And that would make a much better Hollywood movie, wouldn't it? It would inject a bit of drama into the whole thing. But it's just not how the world works. There's no epic battle at the end. More just of a poof, evil no more. God has already won. And on that day, we see from these verses, any power that sets itself up against God's people is going to end up the same way. As nothing, gone. And this teaching could apply to any power that sort of rails against God and against his people. But the highest power that does this, the highest power that rages against God for now, is sin and its fruit, death. Sin, that most destructive and scary enemy that wars against God's people, will one day be nothing at all. As New Testament believers, we know exactly how and when sin was defeated, as Jesus died on the cross. Although we do know it's still present for a time. But sin's days are numbered. We can be sure that there's no threat from sin and death in the end. They just won't be found. Okay, and the contrast here in these verses, it's stark, isn't it? God's our eternal helper. Promises from him are forever. But the enemies, they're only powerful temporarily. One day they'll be as nothing at all. They're just no threat at all in the long run. So if we shift our focus to God, we can be fearless in the face of earthly enemies. Because God says, fear not, I am the one who helps you. Okay, so that was our first big reason to be fearless. On to our second one, because of how God helps us. In the rest of the passage, God gives us some pictures to illustrate his promises. Instead of just saying, don't worry, it'll be all right, he starts to give details, laying down these specific promises. And God isn't like a fortune teller giving cryptic forecasts. I actually looked up the horoscopes to check how to make vagueness seem prescient. And here's a selection. Pisces, a friend will help you resolve an issue today. That's good. Leo, you must communicate your feelings if you want to avoid a mix-up or a misunderstanding today. That's probably good advice any day, but anyway. But God's promises, they're not like these horoscopes. If you're a scientist, you'll be pleased to find that despite the picture language, God makes clear, falsifiable promises. But Isaiah delivers the promises in pictures, not checklists. Not because God wants to hide the details, but because pictures really are the only way to get a sense of what's really going on, what it's really like. God's just talking about something we struggle to imagine. And so he uses this picture language to get our thinking closer to the reality of his promises. Okay, so three pictures. We already saw the first promise in the picture of looking around, searching for your enemies. It's this pointless game of hide and seek, because the enemies were gone, poof. And there was that contrast, wasn't there, between the enemies who are nothing and God who made everything. But at the same time, there's also the hope that one day we won't have to worry about those who oppose God and his people. In particular, we won't have to worry about sin and death, because they'll be as nothing and powerless. Okay, so that was promise one. God's enemies will be gone. One picture down, two more to go. They're in verses 14 to 16 and 17 to 20, and we'll look at each in turn now. So let's read, so if we look down and read from verse 14. Fear not, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel. I am the one who helps you, declares the Lord. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I make of you a threshing sledge, new, sharp, and having teeth. You'll thresh the mountains and crush them, and you'll make the hills like chaff. Well, I don't know about you, I thought this was an odd picture, a bit strange. But let's go through it. So the men of Israel, they're like a worm, a tiny worm, and they're facing off against a mountain. The worm versus the mountain. And it's not immediately clear what this mountain might be, what it might represent. I thought it might be like there's some uplifted hills and lofty mountains back in Isaiah chapter 2. And those were proud men lifting themselves up against God, but who will eventually be brought low by his majesty. But whoever and whatever the mountain is, we know that it just towers over the worm. What could the worm do against such an obstacle? Well, this isn't any old worm. This is God's worm. So it's the mountain that's actually in trouble. God will make the worm into a threshing sledge, and he'll use it to thresh the mountains, turning into light, fluffy chaff that's just blown away by the wind. I think maybe a more modern equivalent would be a blender. It's like God saying, I'm going to make you into a blender, little Christian, and together we're going to blend up the mountains. Just think, it's so crazy, isn't it? I mean, we're thinking an entire mountain turned into dust by God's power, but that's wielded through Israel, his people. I mean, sometimes we talk about bagging a Munro or conquering Everest, but really we just mean standing on top of it. I don't think the mountains actually care if you stand on top of them. But if climbing Everest is an impressive human achievement, and I think it is, but how much more impressive it is to be part of God's people, where one day God will sort of use you, in effect, to flatten Everest. I mean, that's really conquering Everest. And it's all down to God, all down to his power. But for God's people, it means God using us, despite our weakness, to be part of his victory, actually part of what he's doing there. And this promise, it might have been fulfilled in part as Israel mocks the earthly powers that set themselves up against God. I mean, maybe there's something in eventually the captive people of Israel are going to be set free from Babylon, while the captors, they get assimilated into Persia, and they don't even put up a fight. But that might be sort of some sort of fulfillment, but the final fulfillment will be in God's ultimate victory over that proud and haughty enemy, Satan. And we see a similar idea at the end of Romans. Romans chapter 16, verse 20. You don't need to turn to it, but there's almost a throwaway line there. The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. So as Christians, we'll be part of God's victory, final victory over Satan. God will use us, in a way, to destroy him. So imagine that little worm looking up at a towering mountain above him. Imagine a weak Christian staring up at the evil one, the deceiver wielding power over the world for a time. Well, God will metaphorically use the worm to blend the mountain. God will use the church to crush Satan. Imagine looking up at that high mountain, knowing what God will do to it, using me. And surely I've got nothing to fear. It's an amazing promise. Fear not, Christian. You'll be part of God's victory. Well, enough with the mountains. Final picture. Look down with me at verse 17. When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. This problem, I think it's something that most of us will struggle to relate to. I've been thirsty before, but I've never had to worry about where I'll find enough water to survive. But this picture is of a desperate Israelite unable to find water in the desert. Water means life, and without water, there's only one outcome, death. Verse 17 starts with desperation, hopelessness, and the inevitability of death. Except God will not let that happen to his people. So he creates a river for water and adds trees for shade. It's a desert oasis to save his people. Now remember earlier we saw Hollywood really wasn't interested in the way God wins because there wasn't any drama. Actually, maybe the movies would do a bit better here. So camera in on that hopeless wanderer, striving forward, cut and pan, to the wide and barren Atacama Desert. Hasn't seen a drop of water for decades. Back into the wanderer who's collapsed from dehydration. He can't move another step. It looks hopeless. But suddenly, the ground nearby trembles and water trickles and then gushes out, instantly forming a stream, then a river winding down a slope. A nearby depression starts to fill up into a pond and then a lake. Trees immediately start sprouting and growing, bathing the wanderer in shade. And they're rescued. They're sustained and refreshed on their way. It's a beautiful picture of God's creative power used to help his people to keep them going. We've actually seen something like this before in this chunk of Isaiah, back in chapter 40, verse 31. They who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. And similarly, the words strengthen and sustain come up often in New Testament teachings and prayers because the authors knew that God will keep this promise. Whatever happens, whatever circumstance, any attack or amount of time, God will keep his people going to the end. It means, in particular, God will give them the spiritual sustenance they need, the strength to keep going in him. And so we shouldn't need to worry about how to get to the end, as God will get us there. He knows what we need, and he will get us there. So fear not, Christian, God will sustain you. So, through these three pictures, we've seen that one day, God's people will see no enemies. He saw that he'll be part of his victory and that he'll sustain them on the way. And God, of course, has always kept his promises, so we know he will keep these. Like many of God's promises in the Old Testament, we'll see ways that they were fulfilled for Israel then. But we also saw how these promises look forward to God's final victory and revelation at Christ's return. And on that day, we won't be able to find any opposition to God's people, however hard we search. And it'll be as if we have, in God's power, crushed a mountain into dust. And we'll know that God has effectively brought an oasis in the desert to rescue and to sustain us on our way. So, we started with the question, how does it feel to be on God's side? God wants Christians to be able to answer that question, how does it feel? Fearless. But he doesn't just give us empty platitudes to get us there. He says, fear not, because he helps us, and because of how he helps us. We don't have any old helper for our worries and trials. We have the creator and sustainer of the universe. That's too short a description of God, isn't it? So whenever we read or hear something amazing about God, we can remind ourselves, and he is the one who helps me. How could we still fear anything but him? The strongest powers, they're nothing before God. The highest mountains, just a chance to show his strength and the strength he extends to his people. The hardest trials, well, they just reveal God's care for his people through everything. So, fear not. God is the one who helps us.